Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is a special edition of Connections, breaking format a little bit here and spending both hours on what happened in Rochester last night. If you somehow missed the news or just need to be updated, we can tell you that someone conducted a drive-by shooting, and police are still investigating. In fact, Chief Simonelli says anyone with information should call 911. We could hear from them within the hour here, and you will hear it live. Three young men died, including 17-year-old Jonah Barley, 19-year-old Raekwon Manigault, and four were injured. Two have been released from Strong Hospital, and two remain in the hospital, one in guarded condition, one in satisfactory condition. And again, police still investigating. It happened on Genesee Street in the city of Rochester, near a Boys and Girls Club, though the city councilman, Adam McFadden, has been stressing, and I think very appropriately so, it happened near a Boys and Girls Club, but there's no blame going to the Boys and Girls Club. There was a basketball game. The game had let out, and as people were out, sort of making their way out and heading out, someone drove by and started shooting. So we've been talking to Adam McFadden, Rochester City Councilman. He's here, along with Marvin Stefferson, a retired Rochester police officer and a professor at Roberts Wesleyan College. Gary Putup is here as well, representing New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. You heard from the Brady Club last hour, and New Yorkers Against Gun Violence represented here as well. Gary, wish that we were here under different circumstances, but it's always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Yeah, it's a tragic day for Rochester. But if I could add, I listened to your show on the way in. I listened to Dan from the Brady organization. I've been listening to council and McFadden, and all I'd like to say is to start off this portion of the conversation is I agree with what's been said, and from our perspective, this is a tragedy for Rochester, but I don't, you know, from the New Yorkers from Against Gun Violence, from our perspective, I think we have to keep in mind that this is just another day in America, I've talked to Randy, and I talked to the folks over at the Democrat and Chronicle, and I'm not sure what the reluctance is in calling this what it is. This is just another mass shooting in America. And we're stunned here in Rochester because it involves our own. But the question always comes out is, when are we going to have enough? What I'm concerned with is that we're missing the forest through the trees, in that there's a lot of talk about culture. There's a lot of talk about what's going on in the city, about family, et cetera. There are other societies that deal with these same cultural issues. We have a unique history in America because of slavery, but there's gang problems in Canada. There's race issues in the United Kingdom. There's the same racial problems in Australia that deals with its indigenous population, and they don't have these issues. And what I'm concerned with is that we will get so hung up on these, and I don't want to say easy answers because there are no easy answers, but blame placed on culture or blame placed, sad to say, I saw a Facebook posting this morning and someone went and said, well, these are just gang kids. These are just black kids in the city. It made me crazy. No, these are American kids. We're losing an entire generation. And the worst of it is, we know what the answer is. We know what the answer is, and we refuse to muster up the political will to stand up to organizations like the NRA and SCOPE and say, we need to do something about guns.
All right, well, hold on. This isn't before I get to the phones, and I promised our callers we're coming to you. Just let's finish up this important point here because we've had a number of comments online. Thomas on Twitter says all guns should be trackable as to where it was purchased. Then if a gun is misused, the source of that gun can be traced. You heard Dan Gross last hour. But before I follow up with Gary, I want to ask Councilman McFadden a question here. Because Councilman McFadden said someone who does not value life does not value laws. That's what you said last hour. And the argument against what Gary and New Yorkers Against Gun Violence are saying is you can make certain weapons illegal. You can be more restrictive, but someone who doesn't value laws will find those guns anyway, and that's not the solution. Adam, what do you say to that?
Well, I do think that we still have a lot of access to guns that we probably could control. And I'm talking about even illegal guns. On the fact of the matter is we have people in this community that don't secure their weapons, who buy their guns legally. They get stolen. Sometimes they pawn them. Sometimes they sell them and then report them stolen. I think there's this fictional belief that corner stores are gun markets, that may be happening in some places, but actually most of the guns that are on the street are guns that were either stolen or given by someone who had them legally to people illegally.
Is that about right, Officer and Professor Stefferson?
Yes, Adam nailed it. You know, my experience has been that, you know, you've had kids come in from other areas where their parents, okay, or grandparents own weapons, and these kids might be having some type of chemical dependency issue. And so they bring them as a barter, you know, to trade for the drug. And some kids, you know, they have to pay off a debt, and they're being threatened. So they go and take a weapon from, like I said, a legal home, and then it's put into the hands of these kids to go out and do whatever. So,
Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, if I can to back that up, this is why our organization is working so hard on getting safe storage laws passed in New York State. You had me on before, and we talked about Nicholas's bill, which passed the Assembly, which would require that anyone that owns a gun, that they, when it's not in their possession, would have to lock it up, would be responsible for doing it. The city of Rochester has an ordinance. We are working now to get Albany, and these local laws are good. It's a loophole in the SAFE Act. And just let me just take one step back. You know, one of the things that we have to understand, and especially when we deal with groups that say we have strict gun laws in New York State, we do not have strict gun laws in any state in the union. We do not have universal background checks. We don't have registration, and we don't have any control whatsoever on the sale and possession of ammunition. The fact of the matter is whether this gun was legal or illegal. We have in the SAFE Act provisions for a database and to control who is able to buy ammunition. You can have all the illegal guns you want, but the idea that somebody at 16 or 17 years old can walk into a Walmart and buy ammunition makes no sense. And that this is why, like I say, we know what we have to do. It's just, and maybe this will be the tipping point in Rochester. Maybe this will be the time when people say, okay, we've had enough. Now it's hit home. And let's actually ask our state senators and our state assemblymen and our governor to say, yeah, the SAFE Act is not strict gun control. We need to address this problem.
Let me get back to the phones. This is James in Avon. Go ahead, James.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and my condolences to everyone who's been affected by this. A very, very quick background. I was born in the suburbs. I now live in a rural community, but I did spend over 2 years on living on Roycroft Drive and working in the north side of the city, so I am not completely unaware of how things are in that particular neighborhood. The thing that really frustrates me, I'm a hunter, a gun owner. There is a huge difference between upstate New York and downstate Monroe County versus the surrounding counties that are more rural. And that needs to be taken into consideration before there's more legislation that is poorly written and hammered through before as a political pressure thing. I know there has to be a response. I'm not against gun control and background checks and all those things, but it really does need to be thoroughly vetted before it passes as a law. Now, what I get equally frustrated with is people from the areas that I come from and the, you know, there's a very, people often dismiss a situation like this, as you've been saying in the last hour, about, oh, it's, you know, just people of this ethnic background, or surely there was a gang connection or some reason for it. And this is also, I suppose, a broader political statement is that the playing field is not level. There's not economic mobility for a lot of people that are in these situations. And to say, oh, well, so-and-so should have just bootstrapped themselves and they should have just done better, worked harder, whatever, that, as I'm sure many people have seen, does not necessarily follow. You can work extremely hard and still not be able to get out of a cycle of just being able to pay the bills. And not necessarily find yourself in a situation where you have escaped a situation that, you know, geographically lends itself to violence. And the last thing is that when you look at incarceration rates of different ethnic groups for things like arrest rates and also incarceration for things like minor drug offenses, it truly is not equal. You can't just say, you know, well, so-and-so had a criminal record. Well, how many kids or teenagers from a different ethnic background had been arrested, and yet their parents had money for the lawyers,
right,
and the record was expunged. And, you know, yes, teenagers and young people all have similar problems. How it plays out in our society today is very different, and it bothers me that so many people do not recognize that.
Go ahead, Gary.
Question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and thanks for calling. And just to be clear, for you and I'm also a hunter and a gun owner. And one of the things that we've been dealing with is people, we hear this all the time, and quite frankly, I think it's just, frankly, propaganda from certain organizations, that there's a difference between upstate and downstate and rural America and urban America. So my question to you as a hunter and as a gun owner, what is the harm? I don't care if you live here or in Mount Morris or Angelica or New York City. What is the problem with telling hunters and gun owners, listen, you need to register your gun. You're a law-abiding citizen, no problem. Register your gun. That any time a gun is bought or sold, to have a background check, a true universal background check, not this loophole we have in the SAFE Act where you can give a gun to a family member who may or may not be insane. And what is the real problem with saying to somebody, you want to go out hunting this fall? Look, when you buy your ammunition, you're going to need to provide some ID and a background check to make sure. That those aren't onerous, strict laws. And so I just want to challenge you a little bit on the idea that there's somehow a difference between upstate, downstate, rural, and urban, because the gun violence problem is also a rural problem.
All right, James, go ahead.
I agree with some of the things that you're saying. I mean, I have trigger locks on all of my firearms. They are under lock and key. It does bother me when I go in to buy 44 Magnum ammunition that people are saying, well, I can't sell that to you because you don't have a pistol permit. And trying to explain to a clerk that it's a lever-action Winchester, it's not a pistol. And I mean, there's a lot of things where I've already been impacted. And as far as registration, I know this is an NRA tracking point, and I'm not putting myself in that camp. But that is the first step before total control. And that is something, you know, I'd be the first person to pack everything in grease and bury it before I told people that, yeah, I've got all this stuff and I can come get it.
All right, James.
So there are things that I agree. I'm not saying there shouldn't be background checks. I know that the way the national laws are right now, I know someone who is a federal firearms dealer, and he's been sued for denying a sale. And so there are laws on the books, and there are things that ethically you should do and not do, but yet we don't necessarily have the reinforcement. So in that sense, I'm agreeing with you. There are things that need to change, but making sweeping laws based on a knee-jerk reaction is not the way to go about it.
Thanks for calling, James, and thanks for engaging that question from Gary. There's obviously a difference of opinion there. Adam, there were a couple other points he made that you were agreeing with, and can you elaborate? I mean, he was mentioning just sometimes the family background, sometimes the resources someone has mm-hmm. sets you up for what happens next. What do you think?
Well, if you go into a city court now, and I do this whenever I support a candidate to become a city court judge, within 6 months, I try to go sit in their courtroom and see how they deal with cases. There are a lot of what I would call misdemeanor violation arrests that young people are in the court for, whether before the marijuana law changed, it used to be a lot of marijuana possession charges and what I would call misconducts or disorderly conducts, that kind of thing, that when not dealt with properly because you don't have resources to get a lawyer, you build a case file to say that, hey, look at this person's rap sheet. It's long. And it could be what I would call a bunch of juvenile experiences that can land you in a situation that you look as if you're a violent person or have this criminal background, and it could have just been all juvenile stuff. So when I was arrested at 17 on Genesee Street on the same block where the shooting happened, I was arrested for allegedly throwing rocks and bottles at cars, and all I did was walk outside my door. And when I met with my public defender, he asked me, would I be willing to take a plea bargain, and all I would have to do is clean the park on Saturdays. And I told him no, but two of the guys I was with said, why wouldn't we do that? And I said, because I didn't do anything. And I had sense enough to know then that if I didn't do it, then I should fight for what I believe in. Now, that judge, luckily enough, Bill Bristol, was good enough with me to say, hey, don't come back before me, and he threw it out. He thought it was, you know, BS on a piece of paper. But I had another friend who took the deal, and he had to spend, you know, I think like 6 weekends going to Genesee Valley Park and cleaning the park, and he got that on his record. And we did nothing. And that's the difference of how things are dealt with. So when you have resources, your parent could step in and get you a lawyer so that you don't have that type of interaction on your record. So when you have something really happen and a judgment has to be made about your character, that they're not looking at these pages of what I would call misdemeanor or violations on your record and then making a judgment about you. And that's a really big problem. All you have to do is go sit in a county courtroom and then sit in a city courtroom and you'll see it.
Adam, there's an email from a listener named Elaine who says, what can someone do long-term, volunteer in a city school or library, help a child with reading? Adam McFadden, yes or no?
I think all of those things are good, but I want people to understand one thing about mentorship, because that's really what she's saying, is that you have to be consistent. I just mentored 7 kids for 3 years, meeting with them weekly and dealing with their family situations, their school situation, and having to be consistent in that, making their problems part of my problems. That's how you help kids who need support, is that you have to be consistent and be willing to go to where they're at and help them out of that situation.
I imagine a kid who gets a mentor and the mentor stops showing up, that can be really tough.
That's the worst thing possible. So don't sign up if you're not willing to be consistent.
Great point. Janice in Pittsford next. Go ahead, Janice.
Hi, thanks. I'm so glad you're having this conversation. My question, and I don't know if there are answers right now on these things, but one of the things that I constantly think about with these situations is the politics around it. And you're all saying all these thoughtful things, but half of Monroe County is probably going to write this off. This is public radio, liberal propaganda, da-da-da. If our president mentions guns, racism, he's called un-American, racist. I feel like we have this huge segment of the community practically living or growing up in a war zone. And I just wonder, how do we kind of depoliticize things so we can at least agree, like, you know, what's causing the problems, what are the solutions? Is that making any sense?
It's a great point, Janice. And you didn't call to ask the host. My job is to bring in much smarter guests, which I've done today with Adam McFadden and Marvin Stefferson and Gary Puttup. But let me just tell you my own perspective, because I was the guy growing up in the room who was the ignorant, well-meaning white kid in the suburbs. So let me tell you what I think would help, which is that I think we can depoliticize this by improving our educational system to better teach history. And that means teaching redlining, teaching what happened to families that tried to move from the South to northern cities and what happened to them in the 40s and 50s that I never knew about as a kid growing up. You know, I mean, I grew up in a mostly white school, and mostly affluent, outside Cleveland. I certainly had friends from different backgrounds, but I just did not know about that until I got older. And then I started saying, well, wait a second here. This is much more complex than saying, well, that culture in the ghetto's got a problem. Well, who created the ghetto? And if we had a better educational system, I think we could depoliticize a lot of it, because we wouldn't be so entrenched into either seeing it in a little bit more of a whole realistic way and, you know, all of a sudden you're on the left, and then not being willing to sort of see it, or not knowing, just being ignorant to it. So that's my own view from my own personal history, and I'm curious what the panel thinks. I mean, Adam McFadden, can we do a bit better job there?
I absolutely believe we could do a better job. When I look at even how the little bit of history they teach us about, our African-Americans being in this country, it seems as if they try to wash away the real history and try to deal with folks so that they're comfortable instead of dealing with truth.
If I could add, too.
I guess, go ahead, Janice. I wonder, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I feel like, you know, when those things are raised, you have a huge segment of America saying, well, you're not teaching American exceptionalism, or this is revisionist history. And so You know, so there are people who absolutely don't want it. And I didn't really learn that much. Honestly, I think I learned the most that I ever had reading Ta-Nehisi Coates last year in The Atlantic on the case for reparation. So how do we get education to deal with it?
Well, I think, you know, if I could add to and the caller, you know, I think the education element is important, because by having a more objective rather than subjective reading of American history, that's how you depoliticize it. And I think that also speaks to the point that Councilman McFadden brought up earlier. And I would offer that between myself and the professor, we have over a half a century of law and order conservative kind of thinking. So I don't know that cops are generally labeled as liberals. But to bring your point around to what Councilman McFadden was saying too,
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah, no, it's but it's a political system that shortchanges our public defenders. The fact of the matter is in New York State again, and I'm going to put on my old New York Civil Liberties hat on when I was the director there. We fought very hard with some cases to increase funding and representation for indigent defense, for the public defender's office. We look at the DA's office, see how they're funded, but then look at the public defender's office. And Elaine Spall was on your show, Evan, just in the recent past. In New York State, we criminalize 16 and 17-year-olds. And I think we are, you know, at some point in time, we have to realize that that's a political statement. Because science and everything tells us a 16 and a 17-year-old do not have the decision-making abilities a 20, 21, and a 22-year-old do. So we can depoliticize this, and it's just the political will to do it.
Just a reminder, we're about 2 minutes away from what we think is the start of a live news conference that we will bring you from Rochester, from City Hall, in regards to last night's shootings. And once that starts, we will take it live. And with what Gary's talking about with criminalization of 16 and 17-year-olds, North Carolina and New York do it. The rest of the country does not. We're not talking about mass shootings, though, by the way. We're talking about different kinds of crimes. And Marv Stefferson, did you want to weigh in on that now with your professor hat on?
Actually, I want to weigh in on some of the points that the caller was bringing up. Again, when we talk about institutional racism, we talk about the education system as well as the criminal justice system. You know, you're looking at places that tell one side of the story. Okay, if you're that group that is in power, okay, you're not going to tell the part that takes power out of your possession. So you're not going to include all the history of how America was built, or who did the most agricultural benefit to the country. Okay, we're not going to talk about those that created the filament to the light bulb. Okay, we're not going to talk about transatlantic travel that took place before Christopher Columbus that came out of Africa. Okay, we won't talk about the Gullah Geechees down in Carolina who still carry on tradition from their African heritage. Okay, but these are the things that are hidden nuggets. These are things that you have to go out and find. You have to find the books. And then when you do find the books, you have those that will say, oh, well, that's just fiction, or that's not been quantified. You can't believe that, because that author was politicized and their view is skewed. It's not actual American history. Again, you can't cut out a culture. You can't cut out what the Asian community did for the railroad system, okay? And we talk about the land grab out west, or we talk about the Homestead Act, on who was the first group to actually benefit from giving land and homes. These are things that aren't brought into our classrooms because, again, the institution that teaches is governed by somebody with money that says, no, don't tell that, because if you empower this community, then we're going to have issues down the road. You have to keep somebody in control, and this is unfortunately one of the things that creates institutional racism.
You know, if I could, and it shows really what the professor, I think, is saying, too, is just how interconnected everything is. You had a guest on the other day from the Green Party that talked about a unified school system in Monroe County. And again, this isn't just Monroe County, but in America. Mm-hmm. If we're and like the caller says, if we're going to depoliticize, let's start thinking of this nation as a nation. You know, Van White said yesterday, this is my country, I'm not going anywhere. And we need to start understanding that, as Martin Luther King said, you know, we came here on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. We need to start looking at the education system and saying, why is it in Monroe County that it seems to be acceptable that in certain districts we have classrooms of 20 and 25? And at the same time, it's acceptable to have classes of 40 and 50 in the city. You know, nothing's going to get better until we all start to, you know, let's go back to the old motto of E Pluribus Unum. This is one nation. We are one people. And it's not a black problem. It's not a city problem. It's our problem as Americans.
Adam McFadden, any thoughts there?
I agree. That's my thoughts there. I agree. I think for too long we've allowed people to divide us on what I would call social and racial lines. But at the end of the day, if my kid had cancer and your kid had cancer and I had the solution to it, I think he would work with me to get that solution. We would not see race. We would see, hey, that guy over there has a cure. How can we work together to cure both our kids? And that's how we have to look at this problem of violence, that we're all in the same boat, and violence knows no imaginary boundaries. And at some point, we're all going to die, but some of us would rather live our life to the fullest than die and not have it taken away, you know, early.
We're talking about what happened on Genesee Street last night, and I think it's important to remember that there are names. So often we talk about crime and statistics and numbers, but these are people. Three young men were killed. We know at least two of the names. 17-year-old Jonah Barley, 19-year-old Raekwon Manigault, and four were injured. Two have been released from the hospital after treatment, and another two remain in the hospital this afternoon. They are expected to survive. We are awaiting any minute now a news conference that will update us on what perhaps police know about who is responsible, what they're asking the community to do, and anything else they know about the investigation. So as soon as we have word of that, we will bring that to you live. And in the meantime, we're talking to our panel about what they know. Adam McFadden, did you know one of the victims personally?
I know him. I'm friends with his brother, so my connection to him is through his brother.
One of the young men who died.
Yes, the one whose name hasn't been released.
The one whose name hasn't been released. Yes. Wow. Just a very hard night. Now, Gary Putta put it in the terms of, this is just another day in America, not to be flippant, but to acknowledge that, unfortunately, across America, this kind of event is happening close to a daily basis. And here's a comment from Richard, who writes to us and says, have Gary explain how in New York City in November 2013, the city used the registration list to declare the possession of certain legally registered guns, 22 rimfire, a felony, and confiscated those guns. Legally registered possession is a felony. Will never happen here. He's worried about, again, the sort of the domino effect, the slippery slope. What do you say to that, Gary?
You know, I've heard of these things, and Evan, as you know, some of these groups come up with this stuff with really half-baked information. The idea that somehow the NYPD went out and confiscated legally registered his weapons is just a figment of somebody's imagination. And I mean, and no offense to a previous caller, but this is how these organizations work through fear. And that's one of an issue, whether, again, it's education, it's the suburban urban divide, it's the fear factor that, you know what, if you register guns, they're going to take them all away. You know, we can use like Canada and Australia as good examples. When Australia banned certain weapons, only 20% of the weapons in firearms in Australia even fell under that. And in 13 years, 14 years, I think it is now, not a single other weapon has been confiscated. But more closely to home, not to use the foreign example, let's use New York State. Since 1911, with the passage and enactment of the Sullivan Act, people have been required to have a pistol permit in New York State. And nobody has confiscated in over 104 years. There has been no mass confiscations. So, you know, I would prefer that we just deal with the reality of the situation.
All right. Any second now, we're going to be going to City Hall. But until we do, let me take as many phone calls as I can. And, again, if I have to cut you off to go to City Hall, I apologize. Marie in Rochester, go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to draw attention to another segment of the community that's traumatized by these horrific acts, and those are the professional youth workers who serve, mentor, support, care day in, day out. Many youth workers for years on years in the community to support young people. And I think we need to pay particular attention to really thinking about how do we appreciate, celebrate, and support the youth workers who, whether they're the Boys and Girls Club, whether they're at the recreation center, I think about the Gant Street Recreation Center staff, any youth development organization that is on the line day in, day out. They're an important part of the community, and often those centers become the community for the young people. So how do we support those not-for-profit youth development organizations, and how do we support the professional youth workers?
Councilman McFadden, can you respond? Thank you, Marie. Go ahead, Councilman McFadden.
Well, it's interesting because we've had a couple in the last few years that have actually been killed. When we talk about the work that the youth have been doing, and you know, there are organizations like Teen Empowerment, SWAN, that have always had young people out on the front lines dealing with what I would say some of the most difficult situations as youth workers that adults are afraid to deal with. So I think we should recognize the task, or at least the situations that we have placed them in, because I think we believe, because they come from the community, that they're able to deal with that community, but understanding that they really have no formal training or education to deal with it, but they have an authenticity that allows them to be in the community, mm-hmm. and to do that work. And if we could increase the population of young people going in and being what I would call like a positive peer group amongst their own peers, then we could see some movement. But even with that, I'm not sure that that's how you teach values. We have families that are being raised by young people. I have young people in our community that are homeless, and not homeless in the sense that they're sleeping under a bridge, but they bounce house to house.
Yep.
We have a number of young people like that. So when you talk about a value system or structure, they don't have a place to get it from. And normally in our community, it would be the church or mosque or synagogue or wherever you would go to, you know, to connect to a higher power. They're disconnected. So they don't even know how to bless food, something very basic. When you think about, you know, sitting down and saying grace, they don't even have a connection to even do that.
To Adam's point, as we talked about in this program yesterday, roughly 2,000 students a year are technically classified as homeless in the city of Rochester School District. That means they are living on couches, floors, sometimes day-to-day, week-to-week. But in Rochester, Mike has a concern that the panel is needs to try to reach people who would disagree. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I agree with everything that your folks are saying. My concern is that it's all been said before. And gun control is one of the things that I'm strongly for, so I'll just address that quickly. But all of the other issues that you've spoken of all need to be addressed. But to speak to somebody who, for example, is as strongly supportive, as they say, of the Second Amendment about gun control, is to almost ask them to surrender their souls in some cases. I don't know how to reach folks who have those kinds of strong beliefs with statistics, even with logical argumentation, because I think their beliefs are so deep-seated that logical argumentation can't reach them.
Well, Mike, here's someone who would disagree with you. And John on Twitter writes to us and says, crimes involving guns are the only time we blame the object, the tool, rather than the person who committed the crime. And Mike, what would you say to John?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
He says, crimes involving guns are the only time we blame the object, the tool, rather than the person who committed the crime.
I would disagree with him, number one, because we have blamed objects in the past. If you ever read Unsafe at Any Speed, Ralph Nader's book about the Corvair and how unsafe it was and the history of unsafe vehicles in this country. No, we have blamed cars. We have blamed the absence of seatbelts, for example. Guns are, I think, a special case because they are the most efficient weapons you can use against your fellow man. A car is not as efficient as a gun.
And if I could, to support, it's John.
This is Mike.
This is Mike. Mm-hmm. To support Mike too. It's a false claim that it's the only time. I mean, we put blocks on computers so that people can't see child porn. Mm-hmm. That's restricting an object to make sure we do things like have drug laws. We restrict the item there. The other thing is to keep in mind too: guns are unique, and not all guns, but many guns are specifically designed with the purpose to kill people. Cars, computers, and other objects.
All right. Well, hold on though. I've got to jump in because Mike and Gary are going to agree on that. But he's asking, how are you going to convince people who would disagree? And I'm not sure everyone on this panel feels exactly the same way, but Adam McFadden, a lot of the different subjects we've talked about, how have you spent your own career trying to reach out and convince people to see things a different way?
With facts. And if they don't get it with facts, then I keep moving.
Well, you have to keep your eyes on the prize.
Because you can spin your wheels all day trying to convince someone of facts, and if they're so tied to their core beliefs that they can't see truth in facts, then you have to let those people go. And I deal with that a lot. But I don't use that to sway me to stop doing what I do. I actually use it for fuel to reach folks who are willing to listen and at least be rational about what's being presented to them.
Yeah, advocacy fatigue is an issue.
Yeah, please go ahead, Mike.
Okay. I agree with the councilman. You can't stop. But that still gets back to the question of, are there arguments that we can find, say, vis-a-vis the need to address urban poverty and to forget that it is urban poverty because it is poverty, which I think is a great idea. And poverty afflicts us all. We still need to be able to convince people that the problems of cities and the problems of rural areas where there's a tremendous amount of poverty as well, that we should be addressing those in some meaningful fashion.
Well, I would say this, coming from an impoverished background, I would say there's nothing wrong with being poor. Mm-hmm. I think we've criminalized being poor and put that on so many problems. My mother taught me it was okay to struggle as long as I had a plan to get out of the struggle. You know, I never let being poor define my actions or define me. And, you know, it seems like an easy solution to folks, but I'll tell people this. Southern blacks were extremely poor 4 or 5 decades ago, and they weren't killing each other.
So what's the difference?
What's the difference is lack of value system. So in the South, in those days, that they understood to get out of the fields and to get out of sharecropping, that education was the key. And so although that they were in the fields, they made sure that their kids were in the fields, but in school as well. So they taught their kids a work ethic that if they worked really hard, got really good grades, that they would not have to work in the fields for a living, that they could find another job. And that's what led to the migration of Southern blacks to the North. My mother's family left because they did not want to work in the fields anymore. So my mother's expectation of me was to work really hard in school, get good grades, so you don't have to be poor.
So that's
the thing. So there's nothing wrong with being poor and struggling. The issue is not having hope and opportunity is more the issue, because we demonize being poor as if it's this really bad thing. There are a lot of people who came out of poverty, and they will tell you it was that situation in poverty that made them the people that they are today.
Sure, but
and
the
I'm
question is, does everyone have the same chance to get out of poverty, and does everyone have the same sort of rules and opportunity? And
I would say that the opportunity is less than it used to be.
Mike, any last thoughts before we let you go?
Well, I agree completely with the councilman. I used to work in parts of the city where people were poor, where people were struggling with multiple deficits in their lives, and I wasn't sure how to approach those problems. This is one way that he's speaking of, that it might be possible to do that. And then I go to, okay, so how do we get from that point to helping people to acquire something that is, you know, really important and very difficult to change?
Well, Mike, I've got to let you go only because I see what appears to be the opening of a news conference. This is Chief Mike Simonelli. This is actually at the Public Safety Building talking about last night's shootings. Let's go live, thanks to Time Warner Cable News, right now.
All right, well, thank you for being here. For those of you who may not know me, my name is Michael Simonelli, Chief of Police of the Rochester Police Department. To my right is Mayor Lovely Warren. I will have a few comments. I will then turn it over to the mayor. At that point, we will take some questions. I will caution you in advance. I will not be able to answer questions specifically about the investigation, but to the extent we can answer questions, we will. On August 19th, 2015, we received several 911 calls reporting shots fired in the vicinity of 500 Genesee Street. The first call was received by the 911 center at 11:20 p.m. The call was dispatched at 11:21 p.m. Multiple officers began arriving on the scene at 11:22 p.m. The response time from the point when the first 911 call was received to the arrival of the first responding patrol officers was within 2 minutes. As we have previously reported, the information we have now is that a car drove by a group of people who were in the parking lot of the Boys and Girls Club after a basketball game. At that time, one or more occupants of the vehicle fired shots into the group as the car drove by. At this time, we have confirmed 7 individuals were shot, 3 of them fatally. The victims were all male city residents ranging in age from 20 to 29. At this time, the information we have is that the 4 victims who are not deceased have suffered non-life-threatening injuries. On behalf of the entire Rochester Police Department, I would like to extend our condolences and our thoughts and prayers to the families of the victims of this tragic event. We immediately commenced an intensive investigation led by our Major Crimes Unit, supported by every available RPD resource. As always, we are working in close partnership with the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. We have resources available from our federal, state, and local law enforcement, probation, and parole partners. We cannot release any further information regarding the investigation at this time. We do understand how important it is to keep the community informed regarding an event like this and our efforts to bring these perpetrators to justice. We will release as much information as quickly as we can. However, we ask for your patience because many details at this time cannot be released. We are asking that anyone who has any information of any kind regarding this event or may have been in the area and has any video to contact us immediately at 911 or 311. We can arrange to do this on a confidential basis if necessary. Also, at this time, the Rochester Police Department, in conjunction with the Bureau of Alcohol, Firearm, Tobacco, and Explosives, and Crime Stoppers, is announcing a reward of up to $10,000 for information leading to the arrest and successful prosecution of this crime. We have already deployed additional officers, including foot patrols, in several areas of the city. We will continue deploying these additional resources. We understand that emotions run high at a time like this, but it is critical that no one takes the law into their own hands. The Rochester Police Department has forged a strong partnership with this community, and we will work together to solve this crime and to reduce the violence in our city. And we will provide a written version of these remarks shortly after the press conference. At this time, I will turn it over to Mayor Lovely Warren.
Thank you for that update, Chief. And thank you for all that you and our officers are doing to solve this latest homicide in our city. It is ironic that yesterday afternoon, I joined several of our Pathways to Peace people, as well as community leaders who were out there at Don Samuel Torres Park on Clinton Avenue to attend a peace rally, praying for an end to the senseless violence in our city. Hours later, three young men are dead, and four more are wounded. Two of the young men who were killed last night were engaged in our Pathways to Peace program, young men who were trying to turn their lives around, young men who had promised and who we believed we could help and we could save from this culture of violence. As a mayor of this city, I am angry that people are losing their lives on our streets. As a mother, I am outraged and devastated. Having spoken with several mothers and fathers today, who will never see their children alive again, it is unacceptable that people in our community would feel comfortable taking another life. Death is final. There is no coming back. There is no tomorrow. A fun and peaceful basketball tournament at the Boys and Girls Club ended with laughing as people walked home, but soon turned into a bloodbath because someone thought it was okay to open up fire into the crowd. When people lose their lives like this, we often see the faces of the victims for a moment, a few days, maybe even a few weeks. We don't really understand the ongoing pain or see the faces of the families that are left behind, their hurt, their pain, year after year. Having lost friends and loved ones to tragic events like this, it never gets any easier. There are no words that can be said that will bring comfort to the families. Even at City Hall today, I had to console my intern who was there last night, who saw the bodies of the victims and who had a young family member wounded. Our tears and frustration that we all share. I said last night at the prayer vigil that when we lose a loved one to violence, this entire city loses. When we lose a loved one to the justice system, this entire city loses. When we lose a person because they failed to receive a proper education, this entire city loses. What message can I give to both those grieving today and to our entire city as a whole? I would give the same message that I gave to those grieving family members that I spoke to earlier. We will do everything in our power to hold those responsible and bring them to justice. I have authorized Chief Simonelli and the Rochester Police Force to use every resource at their disposal to find the perpetrators of this act of violence and bring them to justice. I have talked directly to the district attorney and asked her to do the same. Even with the best programs, like Pathways to Peace, Operation Transformation Rochester, Clergy on Patrol, and all we are doing in our recreation centers, in our libraries, there are individuals that we are not reaching. Unfortunately, we cannot legislate morality. So we need your help. The violence needs to stop here and now. If you know something about this event, please come forward so we can bring these people to justice. If you know someone with an illegal weapon, please report it. We are asking the friends and families of the victims to not retaliate. We need for you to allow us to bring these people to rightful justice. And that justice is prosecuting them to the fullest extent of the law. You have often heard me say that our police department, our clergy, our staff, our council, and I, as mayor, can't do this alone. The community as a whole needs to say enough is enough and come forward to cooperate and in the culture that thinks it's okay to take lives. I recognize that there is more we need to do And that is why I pushed for and called for safer neighborhoods. And I've continued to prioritize for a system where residents can have good jobs and kids can receive a good education. In neighborhoods where you have all three of these, you rarely see drive-by shootings. When I make the connection between jobs, safer neighborhoods, and better schools, it isn't just about a soundbite. It is because I sincerely believe that through these three priorities, we will provide hope to the hopeless. I am in our neighborhoods almost every day talking about and working on these three priorities. We have returned our police officers to the neighborhoods to better combat this type of violence. I've used every opportunity at our churches, neighborhood walks, our center visits, and anywhere people congregate to discuss these issues. I assure you that I will not let this moment pass. You should not let this moment pass. We need to turn despair into hope. The building blocks and resources are all there, and now we need to come together and turn this moment into the moment when Rochester said it deserves better. Thank you, and we'll answer any questions that you may have.
What is the police department doing currently right now? You've had ceasefire operations before that have been used to address gang activity. What are you going to do? What are you guys going to do in the next couple of days to try and prevent the type of retaliation that is going on?
Well, what we're going to do is we're in a combination of community outreach and some enhanced police activity. We will utilize the information we have. As I said, we've worked really hard in the last year and a half to build some bridges to the community. We do have some good channels of communication, so we're going to utilize those. And our emphasis is going to be on preemptively intervening if we hear something's developing. On the enforcement side, we do have additional patrol resources out and investigative resources. And there are some programs that we use to deal with things like this, and obviously we're going to direct those resources on this.
What are some of those tactics? Do you bring gang members in?
Well, I would say there's a whole wide spectrum of things. Everything's on the table now, but everything from enforcement to call-ins to utilizing our channels of communication. We have things in progress now that I'm simply not going to get specific about, but again, all these things that you've heard about, we will continue to build upon those type of tactics.
How aggressive and proactive are you guys on a day-to-day basis, not just in response to a tragedy like this, but what are you guys out there doing before something like this?
Well, everything that we just mentioned, that John just mentioned, these are things that we do all the time. We literally meet on a daily basis to review what information we have. We try to plan. And on a daily basis, we will modify or adapt our planning and our deployment and our tactics and our strategies to meet developing situations.
Chief, for those looking to help, I mean, is there any information you can provide us on a description of a suspect or a vehicle that people need to be on the lookout for?
Right. At this time, we don't have that information to release. And again, as I said when I made my remarks, we understand the level of concern and interest. And I will say this, if there's any information that implicates the safety of this community, we don't have that type of information now. If we do have that, that will be put out immediately. But if we are asking the community for help, and as information and leads develop, that we can give a little more direction to that, we will certainly do so. I'm just going to have to say one at a time. At this point, I'm not going to comment on this crime or this investigation beyond what I've said. I think over here you were next, whoever's talking over here.
Have you recovered a weapon at this point, and do you know what kind of gun was used in this mass shooting? Obviously, this person got off a lot of bullets. Do you know how many bullets and what type of weapon?
Again, I'm not going to release any information specifically pertaining to this investigation. That's all part of our investigation.
Chief, do you have a sense for how much of the increase in violence, particularly shootings, has been gang-related?
Well, some of it has been. We think actually most of it has been related to personal disputes. This is what we've been dealing with. You know, the total universe of violence is made up of a number of different components, and we really, a lot of our strategy is really directed at what is the kind of the root causes and the context of the violent acts. But you know, I would say right now, based on the best information we have, a lot of the violence we are dealing with over time, probably close to 60%, is related to some type of personal dispute outside the context of a domestic relationship. So that's the context that we're working in now. Well, again, it's kind of complicated, you know, because someone may associate with a particular gang and then get in a personal dispute over being disrespected, or you know, the girlfriend being disrespected, or a family member or cousin, you know, having a dispute that everybody jumps in on. So, you know, one of the things we want to be careful about is we don't want to jump to conclusions. And just because someone has some type of association with a gang doesn't necessarily mean it's an organized gang violence thing. Now, having said that, you know, where we do see that, we take that very seriously, and anybody that's followed this department over the years knows that we have done a number of significant investigations that did involve a little more organized gang violence and crime. And, you know, if that's where the circumstances lead us, we're going to continue to do that.
Many shootings have happened in this area over the last few weeks. Are these related, do you think?
Well, again, we're not going to talk about any potential relationships. Obviously, we're aware of the crimes that have occurred and that we're aware of. And I'll just say, in general, anytime a crime like this occurs, we're very, very alert to look for the information we have and to see if there are relationships and where that will lead us. Well, again, in this area, there have been some recent crimes that we've reported. We have been dealing with those crimes. The way you're phrasing that, heating up in this area, you know, there have been some recent crimes in that area that we've been proactively and preemptively trying to deal with. We have some investigations going on to deal with that. We actually, you know, are in various states of progress in several of these investigations. Right. Well, that's a concern, and I think that's why I mentioned it, and I know that Mayor Warren mentioned it also. You know, we understand emotions run high, but again, this is a good police department. This is a good community. We're working on a good partnership, and that is a way to deal with this. You know, more violence is not the answer to a violent act. The Rochester Police Department is going to bring this case to closure. We will identify, and we will apprehend and bring the perpetrators to justice. And so if somebody wants to contribute to that, they need to work with us. If they have information, or if in the community, they need to really be messengers of peace and nonviolence in the community, and not do anything to incite any further violence.
Chief, you've asked for video from the public. I assume you're also looking at any surveillance video in the area. How vital is that video from either surveillance cameras or from the public, perhaps shot on a cell phone? How vital is that to your investigation?
Well, again, I'm not going to talk about this particular investigation. In a crime like this, video could potentially be very, very helpful. You know, in this day and age, with the amount of video, security video, cell phone video, the other means by which video is produced, it really is. It's an integral part of our investigation. So that's why it's very important that if anybody has any, obviously locating any video that may be relevant to this investigation. It's something that started immediately last night. We're going to continue to work that, and that's why if anybody has any potential video that may be helpful or is aware of someone, we are strongly urging them to come forward.
Chief, in 2013, you guys sent out a letter to gang members. The department did in response to an 80% spike in shootings, gang-related shootings in 2012, I believe, somewhere around. Does that work? I mean, did that work? Is that what types of efforts on your part work the best?
Well, again, speaking in general, one of the things we do with violence, whether it's dispute, gang-related, or any other context of violence, we try to look at strategies that have been proven, what we call an evidence-based approach, that there's some data, some evidence, some reason to believe that a particular strategy or tactic is going to be effective. It's really hard for me to claim success if shootings go down because we sent a letter out, but I can tell you that is, you know, calling, you know, approaching family members. One of the things that we've done in the last year and a half, which we think has been helpful, we have forged a very strong relationship with the clergy, and in this community, that's a very influential group. We've already been in contact with a number of clergy members. We've already had volunteers to work with us to walk the neighborhoods, and we're going to be doing that. So, you know, we really want to look for tactics and strategies that have been proven successful, but we also want to be very open. We don't try to follow a one-size-fits-all approach. We try to look at the particular situation and try to determine what's going to work best in that situation.
You advised the mayor this earlier today about families in the city of Rochester, and this happened outside the Boys and Girls Club in the city, where people were there, as you mentioned, to have fun and have a good time. Are Rochester families safe? I mean, what would you say to people?
Well, I would say yes, Rochester families are safe. Now, obviously, this was a terrible crime that occurred. Really, the event going on at the Boys and Girls Club had nothing to do with it. In fact, it was the last night of a basketball tournament that had gone on without incident or any type of negative occurrence throughout the course of this basketball tournament. But, I think what's important to remember is, you know, every violent crime, certainly every homicide, touches a community. We recognize a crime like this touches a community in a different way and maybe in a broader way. So in the end, yes, we believe the city of Rochester is safe, and we are going to find out who did this crime and bring them to justice.
The four people that are injured, are they still in the hospital or are they treated and released?
I'm not going to comment on the whereabouts of the victims.
Chief, the drive-by shooting seems like a pretty brazen act of violence that we haven't seen a lot here in this community. Can you give me a sense of how often that type of incident occurs, the drive-by shooting?
You know, if what we can do with that and any other specific questions, we'll try to answer. I'm trying to think, rather than go by memory, it's a very rare occurrence in the city of Rochester, but rather than just try to guess, we'll see if we can run that information down for you.
Can you track that type of that way?
Well, we track all violent crime, and we... You know, and there's a number of parameters we look at, the context of the crime, how it occurs. So we'll right afterwards, and again, this, and we have gotten through phone calls, other requests for some information, any statistical information that we have available, if anybody can contact our public information officer. Obviously, since last night, we've been focused on this crime and dealing with this, with the aftermath of that, but any requests you have that we can, any information that you request that we can provide, we will do so.
Chief, a community member had asked me, he said normally there's police officers stationed at the Magnus School, stationed around that area. Were there no police in that area that night, or how close were the police to the actual shooting?
Well, I can't say how close they were, but I will say that we started getting calls immediately when the shots were fired, and as I mentioned when I began, the first arriving officers got there within 2 minutes. Honestly, I don't know where their starting point was when that dispatch call went out, but they were certainly close enough to arrive within 2 minutes.
Mayor, earlier you talked about the need for gun control in the city. Can you speak to that issue? And I know the chief doesn't want to talk about this investigation in particular and what kind of weapon was used, but obviously whatever weapon was used, they were able to shoot 7 people. Can you talk about the need for gun control in the city of Rochester and what exactly you would do differently?
Well, I don't think it's just in the city of Rochester. I think that we need to talk about illegal weapons that are affecting and plaguing urban communities across the country. And that is not something that is legislated on a local level. That is something that's legislated on a national and a state level. I think that, Governor Cuomo's office reached out to me earlier, two years ago. He had put in legislation for, you know, stricter gun regulations when it comes down to weapons. But I think that we have a serious issue when it comes down to illegal weapons in our community, and that's why today I talked about the fact that if you know someone that has an illegal weapon, please come forward and let us know so that we can take that weapon off of the street. We recognize that people have a constitutional right, but when you talk about illegal weapons, that's something that is plaguing many urban communities, and I believe that is something that we as a country need to deal with.
How do you get that to happen, though? You want people to come forward, and that's one of the issues police face, is getting people to come forward and give you tips. A lot of times, that's the obstacle in solving these crimes.
Well, I think that over the last year and a half, as the chief has indicated, we have worked very, very hard to build those relationships. trust is a major factor. People want to know that if they bring information forward, that their own personal identity, their families will be saved, and we have to ensure that that is the case. I believe that because of our homicide clearance rate last year, what we're doing this year, we have more people that are coming forward and cooperating. We have a team behind us with Pathways to Peace that are out there every day working to with our police department, working with our clergy and our community to build those relationships. And that is going to be the factor that allows us to change what's happening in our community, is building that trust for people to come forward, but also for those people in the community to hold their friends and their family members accountable for the crimes that they commit.
Can you comment on how many people you
think are responsible for this? Again, I'm not going to comment on any specifics of this investigation beyond what I've said. That I can say, there was no incident inside the Boys and Girls Club. The basketball game got finished. It started, my information is, with approximately 100 people leaving the area. At the time that the shooting happened, based on the estimates we have, was maybe 25, 30, or maybe a little more that were still kind of lingering in the area. But there was no incident associated with the Boys and Girls Club or the basketball game.
Was there any warning, either from people in the car committing this drive-by or from people who may have seen them reach out with a gun? Any warning prior to these shots being fired?
Again, it's part of our investigation. I'm not going to comment on.
Can you say if they got out of the car, or they literally just slowed down and shot?
Again, I'm not going to comment on the specifics of the investigation. Okay, thank you very much. As I said, we will be distributing a written version of the comments that I made. And if anybody wants any additional information that we can provide, please contact our public information officer. And if we can provide it, we will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a live news conference from the Public Safety Building in downtown Rochester. That was Chief Mike Simonelli of the Rochester Police Department and Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. Our thanks to Time Warner Cable News for providing the audio feed of that news conference. Ran about 25 minutes. And the consistent theme you heard was that they want more information, but what they do have, they can't share. There was one important moment, though, I think, that stood out to me, which was Chief Simonelli was asked if there is a concern for the broader community, if there is a concern that the community should know about. And he said that there is no information they currently have that indicates the safety of the community is at risk. And, you know, you risk reading between the lines too much, but it was a shooting last night in which 7 people were shot, 3 killed, 4 injured. But the chief of Rochester Police has said that most of the shootings, 60% of shootings in our city, are the result of disputes between parties that know each other, and the majority of those of which have criminal records. In other words, according to the chief of police, it's criminals shooting other criminals. Now, he's not saying the victims last night were criminals, but he's also not saying that it was a random act that he is concerned could be carried out again tonight or tomorrow or another time. So if they have more information about this, was perhaps one person targeted, 2? Perhaps they do. We don't know, and they're not saying, and the chief of police is saying, give us time with this investigation. I want to bring in Michelle Faust, my colleague who is down at the public safety building, has been covering this story since the early hours when we first heard about this. Michelle, again, not a whole lot new that we can report there. I guess a reward that they're offering. What else that's new that stood out to you?
Well, the things that stood out to me when I was at the scene, there were many people in the community who were asking, you know, why weren't there police officers there at the moment? And Chief Simonelli definitely answered that question because he definitely had heard that. And he said it only took 2 minutes for officers to respond from the first call. And he repeated that on more than one occasion. Also, like you were mentioning before, they're making a lot of pleas to the community to come forward with any kind of information. He mentioned cell phone video. Again, we're not quite sure if they suspect that there is cell phone video out there, if they're just hoping that there is to help solve this crime. And they're offering up to $10,000 reward in this case that may lead to a conviction in this situation.
We're going till 2:30 in this extended edition of Connections on this Thursday afternoon. And if you want to call the program between now and 2:30 to get in with your questions or comments as we cover the shootings from last night in Rochester, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My colleague Michelle Faust is on the line with us from the Public Safety Building where a news conference just wrapped up. Michelle, I want to read a statement from the Boys and Girls Club of Rochester because I think what we don't want to lose in all of this is the good work that the Boys and the Girls Clubs do. This was an event that had nearly 100 people, a basketball tournament. Let me read the statement from the Boys and Girls Club, and then I've got a question for you. Here's the statement from them. Quote, "The safe haven for our members of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Rochester has been compromised by this horrific incident. The staff and board members of the Boys and Girls Clubs are deeply saddened by this incident that occurred on Genesee Street last night, approximately 20 minutes after a club's sponsored basketball game had concluded. Our sympathies, thoughts, and prayers are with the families of the victims during this very difficult time for our whole community. The police are conducting an active investigation into the circumstances, and we are hopeful that this heinous crime will be quickly solved. We want to reassure our member families and kids that we provide a safe haven for them when they visit and participate in our programs. We have a wonderful relationship with the Rochester Police Department, and they have assured us they will be increasing their presence in our neighborhood." End quote. That's the statement from the Boys and Girls Clubs of Rochester. Michelle Faust, Chief Simonelli, was asked, did anything happen inside the Boys and Girls Club during the basketball tournament that might have precipitated this? And my understanding is he said no. What did he say?
No, that's exactly what he said. He said that there was no incident inside of the building, that all of the situation was outside. There was some speculation at the scene whether or not there was something that had happened inside that escalated and went outside, but the chief is saying that that is not what happened. And of the, what you said, 100 people that were at the event, he said there were about 25 or 30 lingering in the area after the game with no incident inside the game. Someone came and shot into that crowd.
Mayor Lovely Warren said you cannot legislate morality. And Michelle Faust, she seemed passionate and strong in her urging of the community to find a way to solve this, though I guess no one can blame her for not having a whole lot of specifics as to how they do that, but she was really moved by this, wasn't she?
Yes, it was definitely something that she mentioned. It's been mentioned before that of the three people who were killed, two of them worked against gang violence in the community, trying to make peace in the community, had worked with community members to try to end incidents like this, and their lives were cut short last night.
Michelle, Brad writes to the program and wants to know if we've learned any more about possible gang connections here. That question came up in the news conference. What did we hear?
And basically what the chief is saying, they're not answering whether or not it is gang-related. It looks like there's some suspicion that it could possibly be there, but they're not confirming that. All the people on the scene, the family members saying that these people who were part of these peacemaking groups in the community, that they were not gang-related, but it's hard to tell. We've heard some reports that there may have been some sort of a dispute between groups. It's not sure if people were targeted or if these were just innocent bystanders that were shot.
Jennifer writes to the program, "My heart is breaking today. Haven't been down to the scene. What is the scene like down there? I feel so much for the families." Michelle, you were down there much earlier today. I saw a recent picture in which there is kind of through colored chalk the different victims' names. We have two of them, and they are 17-year-old Jonah Barley, 19-year-old Raekwon Manigault. Their names are memorialized down there on the ground outside the Boys and Girls Club on Genesee Street. And there is a big sign written on the ground in colored chalk that says Black Lives Matter. How would you describe what you have seen down there on that scene throughout the hours today?
Well, in the morning hours when I was there, I really saw a community coming together to comfort one another, to pray with one another, to cry with one another. I was there very early, so most of the people that I was seeing were family members or people who were involved, and trickling towards the morning hours as people were going off to work,
there were some people who were just checking in on their family, their friends, and the people that they knew in the community, neighbors trying to see if they had any kind of way that they could help. The initial reports that we got from some of the neighbors, we spoke to one neighbor who said she went to the scene right after she heard the shots fire, and she saw people trying desperately to save people's lives. Unfortunately, three people were lost regardless.
We're talking to Michelle Faust, my colleague who's down at the Public Safety Building, reporting on the news conference that just wrapped up with Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren and Rochester Chief of Police Michael Simonelli. Seven people shot in a mass shooting last night at about 11:30 p.m. outside the Boys and Girls Club after a basketball a game or a tournament let out last night. There were about 100 people on the scene and a number of different shots fired. Seven people hit, three have died. Tonight, we continue the conversation about this shooting and violence in Rochester with a live edition of Need to Know with Helen Bianduti Hofer. That is tonight at 8 p.m. on WXXI-TV. We certainly invite you to tune in for that. $10,000 reward, Michelle, is that also correct?
That's right. We heard that from Chief Simonelli, up to $10,000 in reward money. There really, a lot of what we were hearing from the stand today was from the podium, what we heard from both the mayor and Chief Simonelli, begging people, come forward if you have any information, and they are offering that $10,000 incentive. You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting is how they're saying the police and clergy and the staff members with the city, they can't do this alone. They want the whole community to come together as a whole to say enough is enough. That's what we heard from the mayor. She said she will not let the moment pass. She hopes that we as a city do not let this moment pass. And she says we need to turn despair into hope.
It's also fair to say, Michelle, that when we report on these incidents, and I don't mean to couch it in the word incident in an insignificant way, in these shootings, whether it's one person shot, in this case seven with three dead, sometimes some of our listeners say that we forget to tell the personal stories, and we're going to try to do that as we learn more about these victims. In the case of what I've heard so far, did the mayor say during the news conference that at least some of them had worked with Pathways to Peace in Rochester?
That's right. That's what we're hearing. And we will have some personal stories right now. You know, we're still trying to get all the details. But I did speak to some family members, and we'll have some of those stories later in the day.
Yeah, certainly look for our coverage for that. And I think it's a fair point. I mean, Pathways to Peace is an organization that, until we learn more about what these victims did with Pathways to Peace, it's hard to characterize because we don't know. Pathways to Peace reaches out to people who have been what you might broadly call at risk in our community, sometimes involved with gangs, sometimes not. And Pathways to Peace looks to bring them into sort of a peaceful, constructive family life situation. So when Mayor Lovely Warren says two of the victims of the shooting last night were involved with Pathways to Peace, we're not exactly sure what that means, but that certainly means that they were, I think, in many ways, trying to do constructive things with their lives. And that's tragic. But Michelle, you know, last hour on this program, we had someone call the program and say, sometimes it seems like when there is a victim of violence, the media says, well, but they had a criminal record, you know, as if to minimize that. I wonder what you think about that. My feeling on that was, that was a fair criticism. I think we are guilty of that sometimes in the media, broadly speaking, that, well, this victim did have a criminal record or did spend time in prison or did rob a store, as if to minimize a value of a life sometimes. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that does happen in the media. But, you know, the media, that's such a broad term. I do think that we try to do a better job in public broadcasting. That's why we work here. And, you know, I can tell you the stories. You know, basically, I spoke to one aunt this morning, very upset about the loss of her nephew, and she remembers both of these boys that she said they, you know, not that kids don't have problems once in a while, but they were good boys. She remembers taking Jonah and Ray Ray to job interviews, helping them learn to tie a tie. These are kids that were trying to make something of themselves and improve their community.
Michelle Faust is on the line with us. I see the phone starting to ring. We've got a few more minutes if you wanted to join the conversation at 844-295-TALK. And let me go ahead and grab Mark in Gates. Go ahead, Mark.
Hello. The important thing to remember in this tragedy is that the shooters were able to exercise their Second Amendment rights, because we all know how important the Second Amendment is. Personally, I think the Second Amendment needs to be abolished, or if that's too offensive, we certainly don't seem to be offended by the daily shootings in our community and across America, then at least to revisit the Second Amendment, to reinterpret it. Those persons who enjoy using their weapons could perhaps be put in, I don't mean to disrespect the National Guard, but some sort of national thing where they could be put in a pen and they could have a free-for-all, shoot whoever they want to. The other countries have restrictions on guns, and I think you will find that in decent countries like Canada or Sweden, or the individuals who are good citizens are able to have a private firearm if that's important, and they're willing to do a little bit of application, the same as I do for my automobile. So I worship Jesus Christ. I do not worship the Second Amendment. We pay a very heavy toll. And all of this idea, and frankly, I like Mayor Lovely Warren, I certainly respect her, I think she's a little misguided in terms of changing the hearts. It was Martin Luther King who said, in order to change the hearts of men and women, you need to change the institutions. So there is room for law. So yes, people can have their guns, their toys, but there need to be restrictions. And if after Newtown and after the latest shootings in Rochester, we have to discuss serious legislative reform. Thank you.
Mark, thanks for the phone call. And obviously, Mark is emotional about this. Michelle, I will just ask, I will just ask you, Michelle, Mayor Lovely Warren of Rochester and Chief Michael Simonelli of the Rochester Police were asked about what firearms were used, and they're not giving that information.
No word
if
yet.
They have it.
Yeah, they haven't told us what firearms were used. We're not sure about that. But the mayor did speak about, you know, Second Amendment rights. She's saying, you know, this is not a city problem that's only unique to Rochester. She's saying, if we want to make changes to gun legislation, that has to happen at the state and federal levels. It's not something that can be done here in the city. That's one of the things that Mayor Lovely Warren said at this press conference. But the other thing is, she mentioned the problem of illegal guns. It hasn't been, we're not sure what gun was used, whether it was legal or illegal, but there have been problems with illegal guns in the city. Illegal guns have been used in other shootings in the city, and the mayor did mention that in this press conference. And she went, and that was part of one of the things that they were saying in this press conference, urging people to come forward with information, but also turn in any guns that you know are illegal in the city. Report illegal guns that you know of your neighbors may be having in the city.
The mayor stressed at a number of points in the news conference that people who cooperate with law enforcement, if they have any sort of anxiety about that, that they will be protected with anonymity, but they do want that kind of cooperation on a number of levels. Tony in Rochester called in off air to say he agrees with Mark from Gates. You know, these are always sensitive moments after these kind of events in communities across the country. There are some who will argue that you shouldn't politicize it and shouldn't turn it into a debate about gun rights, whereas others say, what better time than to examine very frankly the possible results. So I know that's a conversation that will continue on a separate day. As we begin to wrap up our conversation with Michelle Faust, Michelle, I have about a minute left here, and I just want to ask you what questions I guess we have going forward here. And the answer is a lot, I guess, but what needs to be answered sooner than later, I think, that the community wants answers to?
Well, I think the community has a lot of questions, and really the biggest question is, how can we stop gun violence in the city? And that's a more complicated question than we can answer in even a half hour on this program.
Yeah, that is the big one. Michelle Faust doing great work for us all night, all overnight, all morning, and all day long here as part of our excellent WXXI News team. Thank you, Michelle. We'll look for your work later today.
Thanks, Evan.
Michelle Faust talking to us live from the Public Safety Building, where Mayor Lovely Warren and Rochester Police Chief Michael Simonelli spent about 25 minutes answering questions as much as they could about what they are able to release about last night's mass shooting on Genesee Street that happened about 11:30 last night. No arrest, and they're not saying just how much they might know about who is involved, that who was responsible. Certainly they've been talking to people about that, but they're limited in some of what they can say here. That wraps up our coverage of this hour, and this has been a pre-recorded hour earlier on Thursday afternoon as we reported on the events surrounding the shootings on Genesee Street in Rochester, the mass shootings on Wednesday night. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to our engineers, Valerie Labenka and Mike Black, and all of the WXXI News staff for their help in this coverage today.